In 2020, early in the COVID pandemic, I joined with several colleagues asking some questions. How can the research industry help lay people and communities find evidence-based guidance on how to live safely? Guidance that answers their questions when needed. Guidance that feels familiar and helpful. Guidance they can trust. How can we be inclusive of the awesome diversity of our communities? We spent several years exploring those questions, informing my passion for community research partnerships. I highlight such partnerships as often as possible in my podcast. One of my primary advocacy goals is to promote research that answers questions the public and communities ask. My guest today, Kathleen Noonan, is CEO of the Camden Coalition, a multidisciplinary, community-based nonprofit working to improve care for people with complex health and social needs in Camden, across New Jersey, and nationwide. They develop and test care management models and redesign systems in partnership with consumers, community members, health systems, community-based organizations, government agencies, payers, and more to achieve person-centered, equitable care. Welcome to Health Hats, the podcast. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege who knows a little bit about a lot of health care and a lot about very little. You'll listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities and the awesome surface of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. Thank you. Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure. I've been looking forward to this. When did you first realize health was fragile?
That's a really good question. There's so many different answers to that. I guess at some point as a kid, you realize that like your parents aren't just older than you, but like that old people don't stay around. But I guess, to be honest with you, when I was a little kid, there was a little girl on my block who passed away from pneumonia. And I was that was really off-putting. So that then, when did you realize that health is fragile because the healthcare system is so fragmented, right? Is another whole thing. When did I realize that we make our health more fragile?
Tell us a little bit about the Camden Coalition and your path to becoming CEO of the Camden Coalition.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you that I didn't expect to find myself in healthcare. I did not, as a 20-year-old or even 30-year-old, think I want to be in healthcare. I started out doing children's advocacy work after college. I was a lobbyist for a children's advocacy organization in New York City, and I cared a lot about economic benefits. Some people might call it economic justice now, but back then it was things like earned income tax credits and better wages. And those were not the issues I worked on, though. You get what you get. And in the Children's Advocacy Organization, I worked on early childhood and issues of the crack and AIDS epidemic in New York City, and learned a lot about government and governance and state and local roles and the roles of the federal government, and went to law school and paid off my debt working as a corporate lawyer, which was not a terrible experience. And I always tell people that one of the great things about the lawyers that I worked with is that they were open to two sides to a story. And I find sometimes that even in peer groups, I am with a lot of people who are not open to two sides. If not 10, exactly. You're so right about that. And that is part of our issue. And so I love that about these lawyers, that they were very open. They were open to the fact that I was there to pay off my debts and was going to go and do something else. And I did, and found myself in a lot of children's policy work, child welfare, mental health, juvenile justice. So when I landed at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia around the age of 40, I was like, what am I doing here? And then spent 10 years learning about healthcare. And I was like, oh my Lord, like this system is very broken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My first experience with the Camden Coalition was at the annual conference last year. Our mutual friend, Janice Tufte, had been trying to encourage me to participate with the Camden Coalition for, I don't know, 5 years. And I just kept blowing her off. You know, Janice,
That's hard to do with Janice.
But, you know, I just was involved in so much and I didn't need something else. And then she calls me and says, this year the conference is in Boston and there's this thing called a beehive and it seems like it's right up your alley. And so anyway, so I went and it was amazing. And I think our first conversation was that I was in awe that there 600, 650 attendees. So this was not a small conference and it was young. And I pegged the average age at 35, and I just made that up. But it certainly wasn't 60 like a lot of conferences, and it wasn't 12. And it was really a diverse audience in a lot of ways. Visibly diverse. It was newbies who were sponsored by their employers to learn more. And it was veterans, and veteran meant 10 years maybe, in an organization, a community organization, with very specific expertise, whether it was the unhoused or it was victims of violence or it was transportation. People had some deep and narrow expertise in their particular community and their particular issue, and they were just full of excitement about what they were able to accomplish. It was very exciting for me. Then when you and I talked recently, what came up, and there's so many things we had in common that really rose to the surface, was the community research interface. And navigating the community service industry and the research industrial complex are really different skills. Like really different skills. And I'm in a world with PCORI where people are totally into community research interface. And I'm like, okay, we're into it. Now what? That's what we talked about, that we were both like, okay, now what do we do? So I'm wondering about, from your point of view and your experience coming through the service and advocacy and lobbying world, and now with the Camden Coalition, like, what's your take on that? What's been your experience?
I went to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia to be the co-director of a research center. as a lawyer policy person and not a researcher. And so I came in as an outsider with an outsider's perspective. And my co-director, a guy named Dave Rubin, who's a pediatrician researcher, just left CHOP to go to University of California, but was a researcher who was working on issues that had to do with, we're just going to say poor kids, really just kids where, you know, just that where there just weren't under-resourced kids and families. And he was really frustrated that the research that he was doing wasn't doing a damn bit of good and was willing to say that out loud, which is something that a lot of researchers aren't willing to do. So kudos to him. And
not doing it, he did the research, he had good findings, and it never hit the front line.
Never hit the front line. Not only didn't hit the front line in change in terms of policy or program changes at a state or local or federal government level, but also wasn't influential in his own system. Just wasn't really. If you're at a children's hospital and you're doing research on kids who are in the child welfare system or kids who are in the public school system in a place like Philadelphia, your research is not at the top of a top of mind. So he, to his credit, again, Dave Rubin, shout out again. Dave, you can thank me when I see you. Is that was also like, was not to be aggrieved by this, but to say, what can we do differently? What can I do with the levers I do have differently? And to CHOP's credit, they funded us to start a research center and allowed us to use those funds to think about communication and policy in a different way so that we could influence levers differently. And that was a great thing. But I learned a lot about research. Yeah. To your earlier question, I learned a lot about research. I learned about how long it took, how siloed it was from policy and vice versa. The questions that researchers asked were the questions they wanted to answer, not necessarily the questions that policymakers or community members wanted answered, or parents. Spending some time thinking about those things together was important. If we wanted to do research that was relevant, we had to spend more time talking to policymakers, to programs. Really, we had to get outside the hospital. If we wanted to do this work, we had to not expect people to come to us.
And
we
so
had to go to
them, meaning you had to identify community organizations that were potential partners and go there?
Yes. Earlier, we were focused on sort of program and policy levers and started to do some partnerships with community organizations. Now, I think they have a more robust program of a sort of an earlier goal, which was community partnership. When we received funding to do a program to look at new way to provide treatment to children and adults and kids who may have acting out issues and adults who may have some kind of anger management issues or that kind of thing. I don't know what we call them lately, but anyway, really just people that needed a little bit of help living together better. We said, we're not going to do this at CHOP. We're actually going to find community-based organizations that want to provide this service, and we're going to do the project at their site. Not do it at CHOP, but go out to community-based organizations and find them to do the programs with. So we started that way.
What I'm hearing is the typical, there's probably nothing typical, but one way of doing it is that people have advisory groups of different sorts that come in. as opposed to going yeah. out. And so that's what mm-hmm. I'm hearing as a factor.
Yeah. And one of the things that we had at this center, which is called Policy Lab, that we were certainly resourced at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia to have, was we had staff that were communications and policy team members who were team members with the researchers. And so I understood that the researchers, especially in a place like a hospital where you have researchers who are often clinicians too, they might be the person who's working on the research methods inside, but a team member who's very skilled at the sort of facilitation and communications and policy are the ones who are going to go out and go to meet with community partners, and both come yes. to the team with their own expertise. And I remember a staff person like this going to a community meeting, and we hadn't been to these community meetings in West Philadelphia in a long time. And she said to me, "What do you think I should say at the meeting, or what do you think I should do?" And I said, "We haven't earned the right to speak in these meetings yet. And so we're not going to say anything. Introduce yourself, but I don't really think that we have earned the right to say anything yet. And why don't we go to some meetings and listen to what they have to say? And let's think in a couple of months about what we have to say." And so I think you have to go in yeah. with that attitude as well.
It took me my whole career to learn that. The side effect of being fully yourself. Yes, I have very strong full yeah. of yourself muscles.
I get you. That's not bad. Yeah. It's not bad. It's not bad. You just have to learn, you know, how to temper it and how to say I'm sorry when there's been too much.
I now have one URL for all things health hats. That's linktree/healthhats, spelled linktr.ee/healthhats, one word, to subscribe for free or with a contribution through Patreon. You can access show notes, search the 600-plus episode archive, and link to my social media channels. Your engagement by listening, sharing, and commenting makes quite an impact. Please visit linktree/healthhats. Thank you. Now you're at the Camden Coalition, which is very different.
Yeah.
Shop.
Yes. Yeah, I love it. We're about 80 people, and we are small but mighty, and we punch above our weight class. I learned at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I spent 2.5 years, my last 2.5 years there in the C-suite, and learned a lot about hospitals and how they operate and what they can do well. And they certainly can do a lot of things well, just a lot of things. And a lot of kids and families are getting the care they need. But I also had a good sense of what I felt like they didn't do well and what they needed community partners for. And the Camden Coalition provided this opportunity to really go on into the community-based side of it, and also this opportunity to work with a partnership, a coalition of hospitals and community-based organizations and community residents. I have 4 of my trustees are from my community advisory committee. I have another trustee who's a consumer advocate. There's just a sort of coming together of a diverse group that was a different experience than I had at CHOP. And so I just thought this is a really great opportunity.
So the Camden Coalition is partially a local organization and partially a national organization. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. You know, we started as a local organization because Jeff Brenner, our founder, was a physician who, very much like Dave Rubin, was frustrated that his work wasn't doing a damn bit of good. That seems to be the common theme in my, I guess the next job I'll get is going to be some doctor who comes to me and says, I feel like my work isn't doing a damn bit of good. But anyway, Jeff actually, within the Cooper Medical System, created this model of the nurse and the social worker and the community health worker to leave the hospital, right? That's really important. And go see clients where they were. And the most complex clients with medical complexity and social complexity. And so we did that, and we were very lucky. And I say we were very lucky because I know all too well that there are thousands and thousands of community-based organizations doing incredible work like the Camden Coalition. The fact that we were singled out by Atul Gawande in a New Yorker article is luck to some extent. We hold that with a lot of humility here. But it gave us this opportunity to have a national point of view, right? Which is not a typical thing for a community-based organization. And I say, again, that's a little bit of power that this community-based organizations have, and so we must use it wisely and be generous and share it. Through that, we really started to talk to other groups around the country that were doing the kinds of things that we were doing. They might have even done it ahead of us, right? They were ahead of us. And the idea of bringing people together in a sort of home for the field of complex care was developed with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and AARP at the time. And so we built this national center and the conference that you came to. And we wanted it to be, certainly for me, not like the academic medical conferences that I attended for 10 years. And I wanted it to be a little bit of that, but I didn't want it to be all of that. And I wanted it to be a little bit of the children's advocacy convenings I went to in New York City, which were sometimes with ACT UP in the room because it was the time of the AIDS crisis. And sometimes it was a room filled with family daycare providers, but we really spent a lot of time thinking about diversity of voice. And I think you saw that in Boston. And we continue to get support from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to have a national center that is really here to push out information about the field of complex care. We do teaching, we do training. We just launched a new certificate on complex care, which we hope will be a way for other providers to really bring the diverse teams that are working on complex care in their program or institution, or even across programs. And for people to learn and people to learn together and skill up together.
Oh, I wish I had known this a long time ago. So my first professional nursing job was in 1976. I was the first male public health nurse in Western Massachusetts. And I got hired by the Holyoke VNA because they were dying to hire a guy. And I was a brand new nurse. And you get into home care after you've been years in hospital nursing. And so I was really fortunate that that was my first professional job. And not only that, but I ended up really quickly having an inner city walking route. And part of that was because the women didn't want to be in the inner city, and I didn't really want to be driving all the time. And so I said, look, instead of paying me gas money, buy me shoes and a backpack, and I'll do the inner city. It was a great way to start a profession because I was out there, and it was all these walk-ups, and people lived in some, oh man, dank and dark, and having, whether it was diabetes or paralysis and bed sores from gunshot wounds. I was so naive. I had good thoughts, but I was brand new. And I mostly just, I didn't know. I just had basic instincts, like who's in your community that can help you. I can only come once a week, but clearly need something every day.
Yeah,
that stuff was not at all organized. And I operated by the seat of my pants, and anyway. So it's really exciting that, but this business about the capacity to partner, this is like not a good analogy, but sometimes, like, we were homeschoolers, and the idea that people had that teachers were going to raise their kids was like, this is not what they're trained to do. That's not what they're there for. And I feel like we want researchers to be more involved with the communities and to have co-PIs from the community and whatever. That's not what they know. And we want them to not only disseminate their results to communities, but help implement. And it's, where's the money going to come from? Where's the, that what they care about ends when the funding dries up, but the problem is forever. And anyway, so I feel like when you got a problem, you got to go to the people in the front line. Because when I was a consultant, it was the dirty secret. People would pay you to come solve some problem. And how do you solve it? You go talk to the people who work there. And they know what's going on and what's needed. Just nobody's listening. And since they're paying me a lot of money, they'll listen to me for a couple of minutes. And I didn't probably have an original thought. I was just a good mouthpiece.
Yeah.
But you.
Yes.
Yeah. So just tell me a little bit.
I see a lot of requests and ideas right now put out there about community participation that seem a little unrealistic to us. And the idea that there are people out there that are just waiting to be asked to be a co-PI or are just waiting to learn about methods or can even sign off on your methods.
Infinitesimal.
Right. But also is it a rubber stamp? Like, really give them something to sign off on that they have. Let them sign off on whether they think the question is a good question to ask. Like, where they have expertise, give them the sign off on that. And is that a co-PI? I don't know. Is that just calling someone a co-director, but you're really somebody is the director? It just feels, it can feel very just not credible. One of the things that and we struggle with this because we don't want to tokenize people in any way and worry about just our own, what are we not seeing or knowing about how we're operating. But we really believe in longer term relationships with consumer advocates, with community members, so that you really know them and know what they're interested in influencing. Why are they bringing, if they're bringing their story, why are they bringing their story? Why are they willing to share their story if they are to advance a policy issue or a program issue? And what policy issue and what program issue? And do they want to advance it to change? And then what's our responsibility to really work with them to think about what the change is? And do they sign off on the change? So that our community advisory committee is a group of people, some of them I've known for years now. I've known since I started at the coalition 6 years ago. And when I came to the coalition, the community advisory committee was very upset with the coalition about something. I'm trained as a mediator, so I had a mediation to do. Just recently, I had to do a mediation within the community advisory committee because we have people who have very different points of view about drug use. We have several people who believe that you're not sober if you are not using heroin, but you're smoking weed. And we have some people who believe that they're absolutely sober and they can call themselves clean if they are not shooting up, but smoking weed. And look at when I hear researchers talk about the kinds of things they want to do, I want to say, you have to be able to train yourself. You have to have some training or somebody on your team that understands the real life conflicts that may come up when you are asking people in this particular thing is to work with you on a substance use treatment program.
Yeah, that's great.
So
one of the things that happens to me in research, so I've done a little bit of research, but I'm not a researcher. I'm on the board of PCORI, but I'm not on the board of PCORI because I'm a researcher. I'm on the board because I'm a patient caregiver activist. And but you start to think about a guidebook, and there are common factors and traits, but it's the boss gives a crap is like a theme. You know what I mean? And so you could put that in a, say it nicer than that, but, and put that as number one in your list of things, but that has no value. Who's that for? The board? But anyway, so it's actually doing stuff is challenging and messy and local.
Absolutely. That's why I love local work. It's why I started out in children's advocacy local, and I just love local work, but it is very messy.
Okay, and so here I am working on a national level, thinking about how do you move the dial 1 degree? It's you work where you can.
I think you figure out how to have community-based organizations participate on research. I'll tell you, here's an example for maybe research funders to think about. We just saw a call for proposals for RCTs. We want to maybe do another RCT.
Random clinical trials.
It's 3 or 4
right?
years from now. A randomized clinical trial, right? The gold standard of research. We've done one, want to do one again. when I was at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we had lots of what we called intramural money, which meant, for people that don't know, like maybe a rainy day fund or a kind of cookie jar. And researchers could actually request funds from those sources to get ready to apply to a big federal program for a research grant. We don't have access to anything like that at all. And we want to send something in to this request for proposals for randomized control trial funds and say, we need funding to get ready to do a randomized control trial. And that's what you would have to do with community-based organizations, is say, we're going to fund them for 2 to 3 years, the way a PI would get ready to do a project, or to get ready to partner, to get ready to be the site.
So PCORI does have that, which is one of the things that—
That's great.
You know, and so where I can weigh in is, how big is that bucket?
Yeah.
They have that bucket, and it's a very effective bucket. And I've been, before I was a board member, I was on a project that was funded for that purpose in Boston. And the people who were paid to lead it were really good. They really worked hard to build the partnership with, I can't remember whether it was, I think it was Tufts or Boston University. I don't remember. It was a while ago. But that was very interesting to see it from that point of view. And I'm with you on that.
But did the university have to apply?
No,
or could the community-based organization apply?
Yes.
Great. That's great.
And
good
so
for you guys.
There's quite a bit of that. And what I find fascinating is that when you think about the budgets that get submitted, like, I'm saying this, but it's a terrible generalization. So that's just, okay, so.
Okay, I'm ready. Like,
the applications are, when I was a reviewer, the applications were like $5 less than the max. Right. And the community, where the communities were more involved, the issues were more like in discussion, were like, can they afford to do it on that budget? Because it didn't seem like they were asking for enough. And that was a very interesting dilemma to discuss with, you know, at that time, the staff at PCORI. What does that mean? And how do we navigate that? Because in a way, you'd rather give it to people who aren't going to ask for every dollar, because then you can do more projects.
Yeah.
On the other hand, do they have the expertise? They're not paying the overhead, which is, academics has a big overhead. But anyway, that's not real.
I think it's interesting, though. It's interesting that, you know, the Affordable Care Act and other, certainly, healthcare mechanisms hold payers, health insurance companies, to 20% overhead, but we allow universities to take 60%. Why the disparity? It's really hard to understand.
Okay, so I want to wrap up. So if you were like thinking about out of this conversation, really about the topic of this partnering between researchers and communities, what are the most important points in your experience? What should our listeners be thinking about?
I think researchers have to make the questions that they're interested in a starting point. But if you really want to do community-informed research, you have to go out and talk to people and say, is this descriptive research that I'm interested in, or is this actually a question that, you know, more people than me and peer-reviewed journals would be interested in? I think that's
asking
really
the
important.
Question. I'm with you.
So I think, and if they haven't asked it, then justify why. And then have enough of a relationship with them to get to, like, if they hadn't thought about it and you bring it to them and you bring it to them in earnest and they come around and actually decide with you, that's a good question. You've already done a great project right there. And so I think that's really important. I think it's really important for researchers to have long-term relationships with consumer advocates, like not one-time kinds of relationships, but relationships where they become educated consumers. And I always say to people, like, you don't, like, we trust in our country that a jury can come together without a law degree, without law degrees, and listen to a lot of information and come to a reasonable conclusion. And I have to say, I worked in the court for 2 years as a law clerk, and I never, ever found the jury to come back with a decision that I disagreed with, ever. Very reasonable when you bring a group of diverse set of minds together. Like a lot of, even my board is that, really, right? It has consumer advocates, it has hospital, they don't know everything. But together, they come together and they help and provide some accountability to what we're doing. So I would say that if you make that kind of commitment to some consumer advocates, over time, they're going to learn a bit about what you're doing and become much more comfortable and experienced questioning what you're doing, contributing to what you're doing. Think of them as like a really well-rounded jury, right? They're a jury, right? That's telling you, like, is this a good idea or not? And that's certainly, I think, how we try to think about it, is a sort of longer term. It's really important to build some longer term relationships, not expect, oh, I have this study, I'm going to go out and just find somebody. When we worked on COVID and we were all in COVID in Camden, and our community advisory committee was key, and we created a community ambassador program. And we did that actually because the state had said that they were going to make contact tracing jobs available to people regardless of educational status. And then they gave the contract to our big state university, and they required a BA. And a couple of our community advisory committee members were so disappointed because they were going to apply. And so we said, do not worry about it. We are creating a new position for you. And we did. We created this ambassador position, and they were paid to knock door to door and to go different places. But one of the things that taught me was we shared the research studies with them. We talked about the research with them. It was really important that they be certainly as educated as possible so that they felt really good about saying to people, like, no, I looked at the research study. There were African Americans in the study, right? That they understood some of the concerns and could say to people with a lot of credibility, that's not true. And so I just think we have to give community members more credit than maybe they get sometimes. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, you do. Thank you.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
This
I
is really
agree.
Fun.
This conversation hit many of my priorities. Of course, I value promoting capacity for community research partnerships through long-term relationships. I also prize serving emerging advocates where they hang out, and respecting expertise and experience as co-equal to credentials. What a hoot to dig up that 1977 article about my naive, prescient 25-year-old self. I'm going to steal Kathleen's jury metaphor. A jury can come together without law degrees, listen to much information, and come to a reasonable conclusion. You bring a diverse set of minds together. They don't know everything, but together they help and provide some accountability for our actions. I host, write, and produce Health Hats the Podcast with assistance from Kayla Nelson and Leon and Oscar Van Leeuwen. Music from Joey Van Leeuwen. I play Barry Sachs on some episodes alone or with the Lechuga Fresca Latin Band. I buy my hats at Selma Gundy Boston and my coffee from the Jennifer Stone Collective. Links in the show notes. I'm grateful to you who have the critical roles as listeners, readers, and watchers. Subscribe and contribute. If you like it, share it. See you around the block.